Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out. Thank God it isn't 100 degrees today. You know, did it scare you for a moment when they forecast it was going to be 100? Oh, anyway, thank you so much for turning out. For Ann Hillerman and virtual audience, thank you very much for joining us. What a pleasure it is to see you again.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much. I love talking in the store, and you have just the best audience ever.
We do have a great audience. That's right. So you may not know, or Ann can tell you, but this series actually, to some degree, originated right here in the Poison Pen, didn't it?
That's right. That's right. It was. I think it was due to your good encouragement after my dad died, and I was nervous, to say the least, about continuing a series that had had so many fans and such wide acceptance. And I had never written a novel, so I thought, whoa, this is unknown territory. But Barbara was very encouraging. And so I had some writer friends, and they said, oh, so what if it's a bomb? At least then you know you can't do it. Somehow that doesn't, that's not really encouraging, but... Well, anyway, here I am here with book are. Number 9. Woohoo!
It's incredible, isn't it? I love it. Right. So actually, you were here with, I think, your husband, your then
That's
husband
right.
Don's book of photographs.
And, That's right.
And we strayed into the idea that maybe somebody could continue to write Tony's books. And
you know, that event really impressed me with how important it is for writers to have a chance to look fans in the eye. Because I had been... I love those characters that my dad created, and I had been thinking maybe I should possibly somehow try to write a novel. And then when I asked people for questions, and so many people would wonder if there was going to be another Tony Hillerman novel, and I'd have to say no. And then they'd say, oh, well, gosh, I love those characters. And it just dawned on me, I love those characters too. And since I had written nonfiction and been a journalist, I thought it's a big step, but it's not like going to outer space. You know, I know words, I know editors, I know stories. So really it was events like this that gave me the courage to try it.
You did. And basically all you had to do is shift from writing real things to making stuff up, right? So that worked out.
Oh, you make it
well.
Sound so easy.
Well, now, I mean, I know it was daunting, but you did, after all, have some solid writing preparation, just not for fiction. And I think it would have been much harder for you if you hadn't, you know, had a career as a journalist and so forth.
You're right. And the other thing, and it seems strange to say this, but it also would have been harder if my dad, Tony Hillerman, had said, oh, darling, after I'm gone, I want you to keep these characters alive. The torch is passed, blah, blah, blah. I would still be working on the first book. Because I would have been so intimidated by thinking, oh my goodness, now my pop-up in heaven is going to be disappointed if I have even one typo. I mean, honestly, I think it was good. I don't know if it was intentional or if he just kind of forgot about telling me that maybe I could do the series, but whatever, I'm glad he didn't. And that really kind of freed me up to, you know, bring Bernadette Manuelito as a full-fledged crime solver and not have the pressure of thinking my dad might be disappointed.
I'm sure he wouldn't have been disappointed, but you bring up a really good point, which is introducing Bernie gave you a different viewpoint and a female viewpoint. But we are back in this book, Lost Birds. Joe's back from Hawaii, and Joe is actually the lead character in Lost Birds. So it's been quite a while since we've seen the legendary lieutenant in action, but here he is.
That's right. I missed him. I have to say,
You exiled him. I mean, come on.
It was me. I confess, yeah. But the time had come to bring him back from exile.
I agree. And, you know, I was interested because he and Louisa have had this kind of questionable, well, not questionable, but undefined relationship is the way I will put it. And we learn in this book, this is not a spoiler, that Joe has actually asked her to marry him and she has turned him down, but maybe not forever. You kind of left that dangling. But at least you gave some context now to the fact, you know, that they'd been roommates forever.
Right, right, right.
Do you think the TV is pushing you a little bit in that direction? Dark Winds 1 and 2 are out, and Dark Winds 3 is filming now to show in January of 2025, according to your newsletter.
That's right. Yeah, they're filming now outside of Santa Fe. So, yeah, it's cool. No, actually, I don't think so. I think I had just been, I thought, kind of like Bernadette Manuelito, Louisa Bourbonnais was another character who my dad had created. He kind of creates her as a difficult woman to start with. She comes in and gives Joe Leaphorn a hard time, but then eventually they become friends and then they become housemates. But Dad never did much else with that relationship, and actually I haven't either. So it was fun in Lost Birds to kind of explore the character of Louisa a little more. I enjoyed that, and I'm not sure. I have an idea of what might happen next, but I'm not going to talk about it till we're talking about the next book. But okay. Anyway, it was really fun to have a chance to get to know her a little bit more through the process of writing about her.
So what's she actually doing? I mean, you know, Hawaii was not just all fun and play for her.
No, she's an ethnologist. And so she was in Hawaii talking to Hawaiian natives about stories that had to do with spirituality and looking for connections among a lot of indigenous people, you know, for themes and maybe characters that would be the same in a lot of these stories. So she came back from Hawaii. I think Joe had different expectations, but anyway, she came back from Hawaii with lots of work to do. She had notes from all of these people who she had talked to. So in the meantime, Joe goes back to his private detective work, and that's one of the themes of Lost Birds.
So it's really handy if you're a private detective, if you're a former cop, because you do have a way to get, you know, serving policemen to help you out that would be much more difficult than others. Lots of private detective novels really have sort of tame, don't they? Pretty much have tame policemen that they work with. Lord Peter Wimsey, it's his brother-in-law. It's Colonel Hastings for Poirot. It's, I'm trying to remember, there are three or four.
The Kellermans.
For Spencer. Yeah. Right. So anyway, Joe is helped out, but he takes on, in this case, to kick it off, he takes on a really unusual assignment.
That's right. When I was working on Lost Birds, the Native, I think it's called the Native Child Welfare Act, but that's not exactly right. And anyway, the law that says Indigenous children need to be raised in their own families, a family who I might get this wrong, either they had adopted or wanted to adopt a child that they'd been fostering, and the law said no, you can't. This is a Native child, and this child needs to be raised by her Native community. So that was in my mind, and I was thinking before this act was passed. A lot of Native children were adopted outside of their communities. And so then I was thinking, what if one of these children decides that it would be interesting to go back and track down her Native roots? So I guess all of the news stories about that case, it was in the news for a long time. I think that was one of the things that kind of gave me the idea for Lost Birds.
There's a ton of genealogy, you know, of all different kinds going on, whether it's catching serial killers or people finding adopted families. And, you know, sometimes it's really very traumatic for the person who let the child go, or for the child to discover. I mean, it's not all joy, but maybe Alex Haley was really right with roots. You know, maybe all of us are driven to find our roots, even if it may come with some surprises.
Well, you know, I'm the oldest of five kids, and my siblings were all of six kids, really, but my five siblings all were adopted, and my middle sister. Her daughter, she has four daughters, and one of her daughters went to 23andMe or one of those sites and eventually found out that she had a lot of aunts and uncles who were living in Albuquerque. And her mom, my sister, was not so keen really on reconnecting with this family, but the family was very, very interested in her, and they reached out to her and they sent her flowers and they paid for her to come to Albuquerque to meet her, I guess, aunts and uncles and some of her cousins. And it worked out really well, which, as you're saying, that isn't always the case. But it really made my sister feel like, yeah, these are my people, and they looked like her, and they had kind of the same quirky sense of humor. So, yeah, that situation worked out well. But my other siblings have not done that. It's like I think they were sort of happy to have had the good outcome for their adoption that they did have. And I have to say, if you're writing fiction, I don't think anything can quite beat having a lot of brothers and sisters, and particularly ones who come from such different backgrounds and different genetics. So don't tell them this, but they have inspired some of the characters in my stories.
I'm sure they have. I only met your mom a couple of times. My husband knew her, you know, quite well. So I did know before I ever met you about your family, you know, and you guys live west of the river in Albuquerque. Were you always there?
No, I grew up in Santa Fe, actually.
You did.
Well, I was born in Oklahoma, but my mom and dad got out of there pretty quick. They wanted to see the mountains and the sky that had stars. And so anyway, I lived in Santa Fe until I was starting the eighth grade. And then my dad got a job with the University of New Mexico. And that job really was what gave him the time to focus. He had always wanted to be a writer. And having that job gave him time to work on his writing, because after he got his master's, then he went on more on the academic schedule. So he had, you know, he was maybe teaching 2 days a week. So he had time to work on his writing.
He went to Santa Fe to report, didn't he? Wasn't he working for I'm trying to remember what the name of the paper
United,
is.
He worked for United Press International.
Okay.
He said when they hired him, they said he was going to be the bureau chief, and he was all excited. And then it turned out he was also the bureau.
Titles matter. It's all good, right? Well, anyway, so this woman comes to Joe, and what does she have in the way of any kind of connection or potential connection? Anything?
Nothing much. She has her adoptive parents. They told her she was adopted, but they didn't want to talk about it any more than that. But she has a photo of what seems to her to be a Navajo woman for sure, and a man dressed like a Navajo, although she can't see his face. And in the photo is near Elephant Feet, and in the photo they have a weaving. And she is just thinking, this is the Navajo Nation, and I should find out, my adopted mom just like this photo, or does this photo really have something to do with who I was as a baby and where I came from? So that kind, and that's why Joe Leaphorn is particularly a good detective to help her with it, because Joe knows the area, Joe knows the people, and Joe kind of knows how to worm information out of people if they don't want to talk about things. So, you know, all of that really was to her advantage. But the bad thing is she's leaving. She has a limited number of days to work this out, which, of course, if you're writing a mystery, is just what you want, because you don't want the mystery to go on for 8 years. You know, you gotta kind of wrap it up.
It's called a ticking clock, right, which is an important thing. You're right, because the mystery, whether it's a thriller or more conventional, still has to have pace, still has to move along, or you'll be bored. So it turns out that the weaving is really important. And I thought about your book, and I'm trying to remember which newspaper, whether it was the New York Times. Anyway, they had a whole spread. I think it must have been the arts section in the New York Times, about a Navajo weaver who was doing really contemporary designs. You know, she's in the traditional school, and she's still sitting on the floor and, you know, using the loom and all. But it's very, you know, not the typical. If you want to see a truly astonishing Navajo rug, you should go up to La Posada up in Winslow. And they have a museum next to which they have turned the old train station into a museum. And they have, what do they call it, the world's largest Navajo rug. I have a photo of it on my phone. I can dig up and I'll be glad to show it to you in the signing line. It's staggeringly large, but it is pretty much what you would expect in terms of design, if I remember right. It isn't something wildly, you know. But what's great is that weaving, in fact, can in fact morph into, you know, other kinds of patterns and so forth.
Oh, yeah, that's right, for sure. And now there are a lot more men who are weaving too. I mean, I think back in the old days, it was mostly women, with a few two-spirit people who were weavers. But now, a lot of families where, say, the grandmother and the great-grandmother were weavers, now the grandson is weaving too. And I think that's really wonderful.
I think it's wonderful too, and I also think it's hard work and physical work to, you know, do the loom. So it's not terribly surprising to me that men would take over. So how many of you have been to the Hubble Trading Post? All right. So Anne has given you a trading post in this book that I thought very much evoked the Hubble Trading Post. So, and I don't know because I can't remember, other than driving by there, is there actually a trading post there, or did you make it up?
There is a trading post there, but now it's closed. Now it's been kind of replaced by a gas station convenience store, which is more practical but less ambiance, shall we say. But one of the fun things about writing novels is that you can change the facts a little bit.
We come back to making stuff up.
Yeah, that's right. So I thought, well, it's not so exciting to have somebody go into a convenience store. So let's just bring back the trading post. And I didn't think anybody would mind. And Joe Leaporn was particularly happy to be able to sit there on the porch and drink his coffee.
No, it was wonderful, but I think you needed the trading post in order to have, we won't spoil it by telling you what, but in order to have the story play out, you needed the trading post and other Navajo rugs to make it all work. So meantime, Bernie's sister is retrogressing back into alcoholism, and her mom is getting worse with dementia. So at some point, you've left some threads there that you're going to have to figure out.
Yeah, I did. It's a good thing I got to have another book on this contract, huh?
Yes. But those are those are threads you've been pulling along through the books, and
yeah.
You know, and they're not leaping ahead every single year, you know. So it's been a somewhat slow deal. But I must say I was a bit sorry for her sister, but at the same time, taking care of a disabled adult full-time and trying to go to school and all the rest of it would be the very thing that would knock somebody with addiction right back into it.
Yeah, that's really true. But it has a good outcome,
it
I have
does.
To say. So, yeah, don't be discouraged, Darlene. Bernie's, when my dad started this series, he had created Bernie but never really done much with her. So when I decided that maybe I could write novels, it seemed to me that Bernie needed, I had to flesh her out a little bit. So I gave her a mom who had some trouble, and as the series has gone on, unfortunately, like some of us, her problems have increased. And then a sister who was, you know, still kind of trying to find herself, and she goes to art school, and in Lost Birds, now she's thinking maybe she's going to become like a nurse's aide or something. But anyway, it was really interesting to me to kind of go a little bit deeper into these characters and think in real life, what would it be like for a woman who had a full-time job in law enforcement and hasn't been married for too very long and is really smart, but also trying to juggle her mom and juggle the issues with her sister and, you know, kind of have some kind of a balance in her life. How can I create a character like that so she doesn't just seem like Superwoman? So
very true. And then we have the sheep, right? This is Navajo, so it can't be a big surprise, but we have the sheep and we have dogs. We have feral dogs and sheep. Not a good combination.
The good thing, though, there is a lot of progress on the Navajo Nation with feral dogs. There are groups that are coming to do neutering and spaying and helping with vaccinations. So I normally when I write, I try to really focus on the positive. But I thought since this is a real problem, it would be, I could use it as a point in the story and then mention that, yeah, things are looking up in terms of animal control. So yeah, I have to say I love dogs. I have a golden retriever and a miscellaneous dog. And I was afraid I wasn't going to be able to come because my miscellaneous dog, you know, dogs love to eat. And so she didn't have her dinner and then she didn't have her breakfast. I thought, uh-oh. But I called the vet and the vet said, what has she been munching on? And it turns out, maybe you guys know this who've been in Arizona longer than I have, but it turns out lantana is poisonous to dogs. And she thought, oh, this is good, all these new young leaves. So anyway, they gave her some anti-nausea and a pat on the head and gave me a big bill. And anyway, she is fine. And I'm glad to be here instead of at the vet.
I'm really glad, too. We had to replant one of our cacti because our little cavapoo decided it was munchable. But what happened was he got the sap in his eye, and all of a sudden his eye was all swollen up. So, you know, it was like a midnight trip to the dog ER and all the rest of it. And so we had to dig it up and move it into a pot where he couldn't reach it. So, yeah, there's I don't know. It's oleander is poisonous to people. I don't know if it's poisonous to dogs. Do we know? Is it? Right. Well, I knew about poinsettias, yeah, because you try to move those. But, you know, you see lots of new houses going in, and they're planting these, like, hedges of points of oleander. And I often wonder why there aren't more accidental deaths here, or intentional, actually, deaths here in Arizona. Yeah, don't even have to make that up. Right.
You've been reading too many mysteries, Barbara. I might steal that idea, though.
You could certainly do that. And then you could, right, it would be questionable as to whether it was intentional or accidental. There actually was a book, I can't remember the name of it, where the poison, it was set in Texas, though, so I'm not too sure how that worked out. But anyway, it turned out it was based on birds. It was a really good book. But anyway, the murder method was, in fact, oleander.
Well, you know, my dad was not a dog guy. I have to say. There were no dogs. You may not remember this, but there were bad dogs. There was one book where there were very bad dogs that my dad wrote. But other than that, there weren't just like regular pets. But I'm a dog person. So I gave Mama's neighbor a dog. And the dog, I mean, it was just a dog. And then somebody said to me, what's this dog's name? And it didn't have a name. But then the dog is in the... the dog does something heroic, so I think, well, this dog has to have a name. So I had a contest, and two readers came up with the same name.
Really?
Yeah, which is Bidzil, which means he who is strong. So I thought that was a perfect name for that dog. So that dog is in the books, and that dog is doing fine, and it's not causing any trouble or getting poisoned or eating cactus or whatever.
All that stuff. So the other thing I find really interesting is the evolution of Jim Chi into a kind and caring husband, because if I remember right, he and Joe didn't always see eye to eye way back in the beginning. And wasn't Jim kind of on a quest to become a medicine man or something? Don't I remember that?
Yeah.
I mean, I read Tony in real time. Give me a break. It was 1975 or something. And so, you know, I don't necessarily, I still remember The Blessing Way, though. Boy, was that ever an eye opener if you didn't actually know Arizona that well. You know, there were so many things in it that I thought were amazing. But anyway, at some point, Jim had kind of a chip on his shoulder or was sort of lost or something. Anyway, wanted to be a medicine man. And Joe took us to Tony took us to two or three kind of ceremonies to show us what was going on.
Yeah, that's right. And in Sacred Bridge, Jim Chi pursues that thread a little bit. And also in Way of the Bear, when they're up in Utah, he meets with a medicine man who might be his mentor. This book, Lost Bridge, doesn't get into that so much. You know, it's funny. It's kind. I can understand why people write like trilogies, because there's so many threads that are going through my brain, and it's like the strongest one kind of pulls me through. And so in this one, the Jim Chi as a healer was kind of set aside.
There's not room to do everything that you want to do in any one book. And after all, you inherited, you know, a considerable legacy that that you have to deal with. You can't go back and undo some of the things that your dad did.
No, and I wouldn't want to, really.
No,
I mean, I think,
he
set it up really, really nicely. But for a new writer, I mean, I think a lot of writers, you know, you have a crime solver, and then maybe that person has a friend who, you know, puts gas in the car for her or whatever. But by the time I took over the series, Jim Chi and Joe Leaporn both were really strong characters. And then I thought, well, since I can't be Tony Hillerman, I need to do something different. So that was why I brought Bernie up to be. But then I had three characters, and it's like, whoa, that's kind of a lot. So I think that's why when I'm starting a book, I try to think who is going to be driving the story. And in this book, it was really time for Joe Leaporn to come back and to, you know, use his brain. And there's some scenes. He looks up his old friend Captain Largo, and they kind of work together to help solve the case. But that meant Jim doesn't have a whole lot to do in this book. He kind of serves as backup to Joe. But Bernie's pretty busy. So
he's pretty busy. Actually, yeah. Captain Largo was pretty busy. And I wondered if he was going to be recruited to work in the private eye agency. So more to come there. We'll find out. So I guess the other thing that we ought to talk about a bit is that, you know, because they are Navajo law enforcement, they really need to somehow stay in Navajo territory. We see that going on sometimes when there are chases over here on the Pima Reservation, you know, and the Scottsdale police or the Mesa police, and it's a mess. And so you have really been exploring the outer boundaries of the Navajo Reservation, right? How do you decide where you want to go? Is it the story first and then you find the place, or do you see a place and that inspires the story? I think the Malpai has inspired your story in that book.
I see the place and that inspires the story. I love those elephant feet. And I just thought, how could I work this into a story? And then I've driven by them so many times, and there's always somebody there taking a picture. I thought, a picture of these that could be a clue. And then, you know, there are writers, really good writers, who can write from outlines. So they would take that and then they would have, you know, point B, point C, page 85. How do they do that? But I just kind of start writing and see where it leads. And that was pretty much what happened with Elephant Feet. The other thing in this book, there is an explosion at a school. And I didn't want to kind of put an onus on any part of the Navajo Nation. So this is really the first book where I've made up a place. Because I just thought and then there are some nefarious people who are involved with that. I thought, I don't want any community to have to say, oh, you know, you did us wrong. You didn't present us as we really are. So I made that up. And actually, it wasn't as hard as I thought. I think because I've been living in the world of imagination for a while, so I could kind of see it. And it's sort of a composite of a lot of different places that I've visited.
So you're really lucky that the Navajo Reservation is immense. I mean, you know, if you were back in Connecticut, it would be a lot smaller. So, you know, where, I mean, you've pretty much circled it. So where are you coming back to in your next book? Can you tell us that? Spoiler?
No, actually, one of the themes of my, I'm going back to Shiprock, the Shiprock Farmington area, but one of the themes in that book is the something that happened right here in Phoenix. All of those poor Native people who were struggling with addiction, who were basically kidnapped on the Navajo Nation and then brought back here and guys. In prison, I guess is what you would say, in like fake sober homes. And eventually the Navajo Nation and the Phoenix police kind of worked together to bring them home.
It was so old England. It was like people got slammed into bedlam or something. You know, The Woman in White, the Wilkie Collins book, you know, it was that's where they used to stash women that, you know, they either wanted to get rid of or wanted to rip off their inheritance or something. You could incarcerate people. And, you know, that was kind of a similar thing. Surprising how long they got away with it, I thought.
I did too, because evidently it had been years.
A long time.
Yeah.
But then we've been reading about the Gilbert Goons, and that's just so hard to imagine how they got away with that for so long. You know, it doesn't give you a lot of confidence in law enforcement in different areas. But so, right.
Yeah. And then, what was I going to say? Oh, the other thing in Lost Birds has to do with a site near Shiprock where there are revival meetings. There's a whole movement in sort of Navajo Christianity to, you know, go in a tent and there's music and speakers and all. So one of the stories in that has to do with something that looks like that's what it is, but of course it really isn't because it's a mystery.
Have you ever thought about doing something with all the Navajo jewelers that are selling things? You know, I mean, if you go to Sedona, they're out there. And, you know, I've often wondered how vulnerable they were, you know, to people who want to attack them, rip them off, whatever.
And then the other part of that is how so much of that jewelry is copied, you know, overseas. There's even a town in, I think it's in Taiwan. They named it Zuni. Specifically, so they could call it, say, this is jewelry from Zuni. Yeah. Yeah, it's clever, but it's awful.
There was a huge fad, might have been in the 1980s, for Navajo jewelry. And if you went up on Madison Avenue in New York, it was like every store on Madison Avenue for blocks was selling authentic Navajo jewelry. You know, I mean, fashions come and go, including jewelry fashions. I was reading the New York Times this morning, and Cartier has launched a new ring. And I'm telling you, they must have spent like $500,000 on advertising, because it's not cheap to advertise in color in the New York Times. But they kept, every time you did something, they had yet another scenario for people wearing the ring. So, I mean, there's a ton of money in jewelry.
True. Yeah. You know, speaking of New York, I have to brag on Dark Winds, the movie that is based on my characters and my dad's characters. The script for the final, this was the final version of season two. If some of you, have any of you seen Dark Winds? Oh, good. Okay. Well, if you haven't seen it, it's AMC created it, and they hired a bunch of native writers to work on it. And so the last script for the last season is nominated for an Edgar Award, which is like, it's like the Academy Awards of mystery writing. Mystery Writers of America puts this on, and there are only five scripts that are nominated, that Dark Wind script, and then three from a show called Poker Face that I had never seen, but it's really pretty clever. And then one of the Will Trent scripts. So I'm going to go to New York. I haven't been to New York. I'm actually kind of terrified, but anyway.
Been to New York?
I have been to New York, but not for years.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm going to go and be rooting for Dark Winds, but just getting nominated is really such a big deal. So I'm happy. I'm happy for the writers, and I'm happy for everybody who was involved with it.
A red carpet moment. I love it. Right. What are you going to wear?
Oh, I don't know. I'm terrible with fashion. I mean, it's like, oh, I'm something black, because that's, you know, you have to wear black, I think.
With some
turquoise jewelry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You have to do that. Oh, Lord, so funny. Yeah, well, it sounds exciting. All right, questions from the audience. I know lots of you had questions, so.
So the question is, do I wake up in the middle of the night with a great idea and write it down and think that would be a good scenario? Not so much in the middle of the night, but often just at sporadic times during the day, I'll think, oh, wait a minute, I should do such and such and such and such, and that would be more tension. Or I'll think, wait a minute, that isn't right. And then it kind of goes both ways. But yeah, it's funny. Once I'm living in that world of imagination, seems like there are just a lot of little sparks that come. I wish I knew what it was that made them come. And then I would be in that space a lot more.
Drugs or whatever.
Drugs.
Right. Oh, try that. No, it really is. Many writers, you know, have sat here and said that it's when they're not writing. They're taking a walk, they're in the shower, they're driving, you know, they're shopping at, you know, Safeway, whatever it might be, and something comes up. So many of them take notes on their phones. This came up yesterday with Megan Miranda, who's very skillful with electronics. She actually does Excel spreadsheets to start her books, you know. But anyway, so she keeps notes on her phone, but lots of authors carry notepads around and, you know, scribble stuff down or sticky notes or something, because you never know when this odd moment is going to, you know, going to strike, and you have to capture it. Sometimes it's just a little thing.
That's right. And sometimes it's something that might not fit in the book I'm working on now, but it might fit in the next book. So, yeah, I try to keep track of all of that stuff. How about you, ma'am?
I've learned a lot about the Native Americans through your books. How did you become so knowledgeable about the Navajo Nation and know so much about it?
Well, I'm just a beginner. I really don't know nearly as much as I would like to. I'm lucky enough. When I first started, there was a gentleman who had worked with the Navajo police, who had retired, and he was teaching a class at the college in Farmington. I think it's called San Juan Community College, maybe. Anyway, he reached out to me and said that he had worked with my dad, and if I ever needed any help. And so that was kind of the start, and then he introduced me to people, and then I have a friend who's married to a lovely Navajo guy who works as a translator for the courts. And he also does a lot of work with medical translation, like explaining terms that have to do with cancer or diabetes. And so I just try to keep my eyes and ears and heart open and just learn what I can. Now there are so many wonderful indigenous writers too, and I think they tell their own stories really with a lot of heart and a lot of good writing talent. The Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe has a good program where they are really nurturing indigenous writers, and some of those Ramona Emerson. Her book Shutter. I don't know if she came to talk to you. Yeah. Anyway, her book was nominated for a lot of prizes. She's a really good writer. Tory House Press nurtures some of these writers. So I thank you for your compliment. But I would say I know just an ounce compared to what indigenous writers know, and I just try to treat it with respect. You know. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, ma'am. So this is a question asking me if I've ever been to the School of American Research in Santa Fe. Yes, I have been. In fact, they just asked me to be on their advisory board. And that they have the most fabulous collection. If any of you are ever in Santa Fe, you should make it a point to go on a tour. It's like the most beautiful pottery that Pueblo people, and they also have some from other tribes, but it's predominantly Pueblo people, and jewelry and textiles, all kinds of gorgeous, gorgeous stuff that is very well curated. And one of the wonderful things about their collection is that they open it to the ancestors of the people who originally made it, so they can come in and really spend quiet time just with those pots that are from their great-great-grandmothers. And also anybody who is studying, I'm focused on pottery for some reason, anyway, say studying designs, they can take a sketchbook and copy the designs, and it's wonderful. They call it now the School of Advanced Research, and they have expanded their role to not just be Southwest, but to really be more international. And they're nurturing some scholars and writers and researchers from South America and from India, and it's quite the deal. I don't know. They must do a lot of fundraising. Luckily, they haven't talked to me about that, so I But yeah, that's a wonderful place. Oh, you did. Speaking of Santa Fe, I'm going after this. I'm going back to Santa Fe, and I bought a house in Tucson because I married a lovely man who lived in Tucson, but he also has a house in Santa Fe. So I'm going to be there all summer, and I love Arizona, but I have to say in the summer in Tucson, I like Santa Fe a little better.
I can't blame you. Right. So I will see you. And Doug Preston has written an opera. Doug, who is moved to Friday Night Live, but Monday night on Zoom due to a family emergency, has actually written an opera. And I don't know if any of you know about Zozobra, which is this wonderful thing they do in Santa Fe. It's kind of like Burning Man, as far as I can work out. But there's a very good old mystery by, I can't think of her name, that talks about Zozobra and how it got started in some artist's garden, you know, up near Canyon Road or something, and it was very small, and then it kept growing, and now it's a huge ceremony where people put in their griefs, isn't it? You write down what you're sad about or whatever, and then... Anyway, Doug's written an opera, and it's going to premiere at the Linsic. So instead of coming in July, I'm going to come over for all of that at the end of August. So
we'll have
our traditional lunch in Santa Fe then, right? Yeah, it'll be great. Right.
Zozobra is, they call him Old Man Gloom. And yeah, the idea is that everything, it used to be right around Labor Day. So, you know, the summer is over and your tomatoes got eaten by squirrels or, you know, whatever awful things happen to you. So you write that on a slip of paper, and the Kiwanis do it every year. And they put all of that stuff, they use it to stuff Zozobra, and then they take him to Fort Marcy, and there's fireworks, and they call them little glooms who dance around him. Anyway, it's a really cool kind of pagan-like ceremony that we all love.
No, it is. It is actually right before Labor Day. I think it's the Friday night before Labor Day, if I remember right. So, Yeah, Santa Fe is so fascinating. There's so many different cultural things that all happen. John Sanford was being pretty snide about it the other night because he lives there now, and he was his new book, Toxic Prey, is one of the best pictures of Santa Fe, but even better of Taos, because to make Toxic Prey work, at some point, he has to corral the bad people in a small area, and Taos is perfect because there are only like four roads or maybe five. And, no, I'm serious. You know, there's the, you know, the high road to Taos, and there's 64, I think it is, and there's another road. Anyway, and so John has, I've not read a book about Taos that I liked as much as Toxic Prey. So if you're from New Mexico, you might want to read it. But a lot of it takes place in Santa Fe, and he sort of talks about the different, mostly the richer people who come to, you know, it's the Sedona part of Santa Fe is probably, my husband lived there for 30 years. He went to St. John's College and ultimately he came here. But, you know, Santa Fe is, we still have a home in Santa Fe, so we go back every summer and I love it, but it really is the city different.
I have to say though, I am loving being in Arizona. Maybe not the politics so much, but I mean, I have never seen a spring like this.
Isn't
you know,
gorgeous?
Tucson had so much rain. As I was driving down here, all of the Palo Verdes are just brilliant with flowers. I it's funny, you know, people think of the desert as kind of barren and awful, but whoa,
not
it is.
Not in the spring.
No, it's fabulous.
And we did have enough rain to make it all happen. We have four of the cactus, you know, that get those huge white flowers that are, and they all came out at once. You know, so I'm running around thinking, you know, I've only got 23 hours to go here, so I'm going to have to pay attention. And then I have a little hedgehog cactus that's lurking under the yucca, and he's all orange and beautiful. And then the ocotillo have their flags up, you know, the ocotillo flags are flying. The person who designed the Desert Botanical Garden, some stuff, actually did our landscaping, and it's just, I can just stay home. I don't have to go down to the Desert Botanical Garden and walk around. But really, it's been an extraordinary spring. Yeah.
It has been. Does anybody else have any more questions? Yes, ma'am. Not even an advisor. Basically, many years ago, my dad had signed a contract with Robert Redford, giving Robert Redford the rights to everything till the end of time. And so, but then when I continued the series, there was a complication because they didn't, you know, they wanted to use Bernadette Manuelito, but since I was writing about her, they thought, well, we gotta figure this out. So then they asked me to sign off on the contract. And I have to say, I was a little bit nervous about it because I don't know much about movie business, but I've heard a lot of stories about people who have been done wrong. And I thought, gee, these characters are like my family. And what if? But I knew Robert Redford had a lot of respect for my dad. And when they talked to me, they said, we're going to involve as many indigenous actors as we can, hopefully Navajos, and the same with writers. So I thought, well, you have to have faith. So anyway, I signed off on it. And I've been happy with it. I mean, there's a few screwy things. Dad had killed off Joe Leaphorn's wife a long time ago, but she's back and she's great. I have to say, I really love the way that they have reinvented her. And they gave Joe Leaphorn and Emma a son, and then they killed him off in an explosion. And they made Bernie, I mean, in my view, Bernie was, the series is set in the 70s. And as I see it, Bernie wasn't even born in the 70s. But here she is, not only born, but she gets to be Jim Chee's boss. It's like, I mean, what could be better? So, yeah. I mean, if they had asked me, I might have given them some advice that they probably wouldn't have listened to. So, you know, I think, and it's been very well received. It's won some awards. And like I said, it's nominated for this big award from the Mystery Writers of America. So, yeah, I like it, but I really have not had much to do with it. But thanks for asking.
Robert Redford you can have dinner with him at Geronimo if you catch it on the right time. He's so small. I didn't even recognize him the first time. You know, he's like my size. So I know he probably stood on a box when he was making movies or something. And he and George R. R. Martin and Doug Preston and some other people have created a train that goes from the Santa Fe station down to Lamy, New Mexico, which is where the Santa Fe Railroad actually came. It never came to Santa Fe. It came to Lamy, and then you had to get to Santa Fe. And, you know, that's really fun. It's like the Verney Canyon Railroad or, you know, a smaller version of the Silverton, you know, the one from Durango to San to, and then there's a beautiful one that goes from Chama, New Mexico to San Antonitas, Colorado. That's one of my favorites. So, you know,
And then the Grand Canyon Railroad. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. But my point was that Robert Redford and George are pretty much embedded in Santa Fe and not likely to really have done you wrong.
That was what I was hoping. Probably and sure enough.
Yeah, probably neither one of them really needed money, which is a major consideration when you think about it all. Who else has a question?
A little question. Seems to me that before the pandemic, you took people on a tour of all the places that your father wrote about on the reservation. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the question is taking people on a tour of places on the reservation that Dad wrote about. Yes, it was through Rhodes Scholar. In fact, two of my my victims are here. It was great. We really had a good time. And then that tour was partly based on the Tony Hillerman landscape book. That was the first. That was the nonfiction book I did that then brought me to fiction. And so then, before the pandemic, they stopped doing that tour. And now I'm just so busy, I don't think I could do it. But I loved it. Maybe if I decide I want to take a year off, I might. Somebody might be able to twist my arm.
She takes a year off, though, that costs us a book. So you have to think about that. There actually was, and I don't remember, there was a little company that made a nifty map. And then they actually added, Bernie, it was called Top Something or Other Maps.
It was a guy from Cortez.
Yes, he was.
His name may come to me. But
well, I thought that I saw, I'm not sure if we don't have some now, because I thought I saw them resurrected at a regular distributor. But we sold hundreds of them that people would come in and buy, and then you could, you know, the maps were studded with all the places and the books and the whole bit, and they added Bernie, or at least up until the point where they, you know, stopped doing it.
He added the first two or three of my books.
At least that
books.
Many.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was very cool, but it was like a regular thing that we sold here. And then I don't know whether he went out of business or whether he retired or whether I just, you know, screwed up and forgot to order, which is always possible. But I'll check and see. John, you can hear me. Is there a Tony Hillerman map somewhere up in the front? Was I able to order some? I tried. We'll find out. Because it's really cool. And then you could do a self-driving version of it. Well, that was the reason.
And I know you have had a question. You had your hand up for several times.
You know, your characters that you write about and are certainly my favorite characters of any author that I've read about. And I get the biggest kick out of more people than you would think occasionally ask me. As a professor, I was a professor at Northern Arizona University, and they'll ask me, do you happen to know this Louisa? She works for NAU.
That's so much fun. I know. Isn't it wonderful how people get invested in characters? And do you know, when authors, I mean, this sounds macabre, but it's true. When an author dies, people come in and they don't say, oh, we're so sorry to lose Bob or them. They say, what's going to happen to Spencer? You know? I mean, it's really the characters that people get invested in. And I'm sure there were people after your dad died who really did truly miss the characters. You know, they were like family and are very pleased that you are doing them again.
Yeah, that's. But people were kind to me too. I have to say, people a lot, because my dad did so much speaking. So many people would come up and they say, "Oh, we met your dad in Las Cruces. We met your dad in Flagstaff," and they'd say, "You know, he signed a book for my great aunt, and he signed a book for my niece, and blah blah blah." It made me feel good.
He was here a lot. And more interestingly, you probably don't. Well, there's no reason you would know this, but publishers have the rights to titles and to the production of the book and to the art. And there was an author, an artist, I can't remember his name now, who did most of the early covers for Tony's books. And one day he showed up and he said, you know, because he still owned the original art. He licensed it to HarperCollins. And he said, would you like to sell my art? And Iron Prince said the store for several years was just paved in Tony Hilleman art and covers. And they've all sold by now. But, you know, I have, remember the Mudhead Kiva? I have the cover for the book that HarperCollins made up when Tony wasn't able to write a book one year. It was called The Mudhead Kiva. Then it subsequently became Sacred Clowns. It was the one up on the, what is the name of the tribe up there? You know, the ones with the you know, the funny little idols. It'll come to me. Anyway, so I actually have the artwork for the Mudhead Kiva. And when the biographer, Tony's biographer, came to my house to interview me for a day while he was writing the book, you know, he came so he could see the cover. You know, I pulled it out and showed it to him, and I could see he really lusted after him. But, you know, I should think about where are the archives for Tony?
Oh, that's a good question.
I should really think about donating it back when something happens to me.
Dad donated all of his old manuscripts and a lot of stuff to the University of New Mexico, their Southwest Studies Center.
Okay.
And he also gave them enough money so they could digitize it. So they say, if you're looking through the original manuscript for Dark Wind, and you come across something that says Hand Trembler, and you think, what is that? You can click on it, and it will refer you not just to Wikipedia, but to either Dad's research on it or to things that are in the University of New Mexico collection.
Okay.
It's really an interesting site, not only for people who are Hillerman fans, but for anybody who's doing research on Navajos or the Southwest or anything kind of related to those books.
I'll go home and add another codicil to my will, which is, I really should do that because it's going to be completely wasted otherwise. PK, do you have some online? Come out here.
I do.
Nobody can see you. He has some questions from the audience who's watching this virtually.
I was hiding in the rafters.
I saw you lurking over there.
So we've got one of our people online, Renee, was wondering about your character development and whether or not your characters ever run away with the plot from you. She wants to know, basically, how do you do character development, and do they take over?
Yeah, they do take over. But the bad thing is when they don't take over. I mean, that's my second book, Rock with Wings. I'd worked on that book, and this was after I'd written Spider-Woman's Daughter, where Bernie is the main person. So in Rock with Wings, I think, oh, these guys are married. They should solve a crime together. It would be so much easier, right, to have them working together. Bernie was having none of it, and she did not talk to me. And it was, I have to say, I thought maybe I'm going to be a one-book wonder. And finally, you know, I mentioned my dog that ate that lantana. She and I would walk in the morning, and she's a very good listener. So I was complaining, more complaining. And finally, it dawned on me that Bernie had been this sidekick forever, and she did not want to be a sidekick. She wanted her own story. So Bernie, once I figured that out, then Bernie started talking to me again. So that was better. Character development just kind of comes as the story is growing. For me, I think if I'd had some classes in creative writing, I would be more skilled at this. But as the story goes on, the characters kind of tell me who they are and what they know, and it's sort of the characters kind of develop as the plot develops.
Another one?
Yeah, they also want to know, what's your involvement with the AMC show? They were wanting to know what that's like. Also, there are a lot of questions about your golden retrievers. They want more info.
Okay, well, AMC, I had a wonderful question here, which was basically the same thing. And my main involvement was just signing the contract. Although they are really nice to me. They invited me to sit in the writer's room once and listen to them. And they asked me if Joe Leaporn had ever been in the Army, which I thought was an interesting question. And they let me sit in on some of the filming, which I went up to. They are filming near Pewaukee Pueblo. I probably shouldn't say that out loud. Anyway, I got to go up, and it was Jessica Madden, who's a Bernadette Manuelito character, and A.B. Martinez, who was playing the crusty old sheriff, and they were on horseback, and I got to watch them for probably 2 hours, and the wind kept blowing, and the horses weren't cooperating, and then Jessica's hair got messed up, and then A.B.'s hat blew off, and the whole thing was, it gave me a lot of appreciation for how frustrating it is. I mean, sometimes I think riding is frustrating, but man, I mean, sitting on a horse in that wind, just saying the same six words over and over, it was...
Yeah. Not as glamorous as
not
it looks.
Not as glamorous. And our golden retriever, I had had, this is my third golden retriever. And this was actually my husband, Dave Tedlock's dog. And Dave adopted Sophie during the pandemic. And then when we got married, Sophie decided that I was okay. So now Sophie has accepted me as her stepmom.
So you're part of the pack now.
Yeah.
Is that it?
That is it.
That's it. All right. One last. Does anybody have one last question? No? We're good. One
yes.
more.
There's a familiar face.
Which actor do you think did the best job of portraying Lee Horn in a different series?
Oh, that's so. In the first series, Wes Studi was Lee Horn. And I loved Wes. I thought he really did a good job. And he was a little lighter spirited, I think, than McLernan is. But I love both of them. It's like saying, which of your kids do you like best? You know, they are taking different approaches to the characters, and both of them are a few degrees removed from the way my dad actually wrote that character. But some of that doesn't have to do so much with the acting, you know, as with the script that they have to do. The AMC Dark Winds has made the Joe Leaporn character as the kind of spiritual character and the Jim Chee character as the more acculturated character. So I think that in itself, you know, gives Zahn a little, you know, more of a challenge maybe than Wes Studi had, because the original PBS movies were closer to what Dad had actually written. So I don't know, though. I'd be happy to have dinner with both of them.
Sounds like a great idea. You know, it was difficult to film. The first company ran into a problem, which is that Tony's books didn't have a ton of dialogue. There was a lot of description, a lot of inner thoughts and all, and it was difficult to translate that to film, whereas this new group has done much, much better with that. And I think you have more dialogue in your books than your dad did too, right? So that makes it easier. So
Were you wanting to ask a follow-up? Fred Ward, yeah, I can't remember that. It was, yeah, maybe that was, I can't remember if it was Lee Porn or one of the higher up captains that Fred Ward played. I'd have to go back and look at that. Oh, I know. I love that guy. I'd have to come up with a good story that has more to do with Hopi. But yeah, I'd really love to bring him back.
That's the tribe I couldn't think of. Okay, thank you. The Mudhead Kiva takes place up in the Hopi and those villages. God, it's hard to be old and have short-term memory problems. So I have a question before we stop. Is there anyone here who has never read a Tony Hillerman book for the first time? Oh, you got your hand up first. Okay. Normally, no, it's okay. I didn't ask it to shame you. Normally, I have a different book to give away, but I thought that I would give away my advanced reading copy today to somebody that had not read the series and maybe came out of curiosity. So I'm going to award it because you got your hand up first. I'm going to give it to you.
Well, my sister brought me here, and she's read all your...
Ah, wonderful. Well, there you go. You can get it autographed and enjoy it. So let's give Anne, I mean, this is her publication day party, except the publication day isn't until Tuesday. So this is the advance publication day party. So, right. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.